911, what's your emergency?
Yeah, there's this podcast that's been doing a lot of talking about eating crow, and I've got someone here who's got something to say about that.
I just imagined it, and I almost broke.
I mean, it doesn't matter if you break, because I can just cut it out.
Welcome back to the First Reese podcast, everybody.
Welcome back. It's crow season, I guess.
It's crow season. Halloween in July.
Halloween June. Not to be confused with Hallmark's Christmas in July.
Right. Mm-hmm. Halloween in June.
And I hope we're all having a crow girl summer. A hot crow summer.
Crow girl summer. Happy gay month, everybody. Is everyone feeling gay? Is everyone excited for an episode that is not heavy in the conventional sense, I guess? That is less of a trudgery and more of a celebration of all things 911. All things that we love about this show. We have crazy, you know, recurring spooky set piece. We have unhinged Maddie. We have horrible, you know, fire and brimstone Christian family abusing their kids. We have Buck. We have the gang's all here.
The gang's all here. The crow's even here.
I'm very excited to talk about this episode. I love a good old-fashioned Halloween episode.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't say Halloween is my favorite holiday. What I would say is that Halloween is my favorite holiday, like, to people watch. Just because, not just, like, the costumes, but just, like, how crazy and ridiculous people get. Halloween and Halloween is just, like, when your freak really comes out, you know what I mean?
When, like, Calling All the Monsters by China Anne McClain.
Exactly. And so for that reason, I always love seeing it in fiction. I think there's always so much fun you can do with Halloween. And I'm always disappointed when, like, a show skips over a Halloween episode or glosses over it.
Right.
Because, like, it's your one opportunity in a non-spooky show to get a little spooky with it. Right.
Right. Something I wish 911 would do kind of is do like a non-canon Halloween episode that's just like sort of like a slasher movie or something where like characters get killed off and stuff. And, you know, maybe like Eddie becomes the final girl or something.
Like the Community zombie episode kind of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like that Degrassi mini where it's like Degrassi zombies. Does anybody remember that? Speaking of zombies, this is a random aside, but I was at the dentist the other day, and when I got into the office, they were playing like some kind of Disney Channel playlist. Like when I got in there, they were playing Bed on it, and then it switched to some Demi Lovato song from back in the day, and then they started playing some song from Zombies, which I haven't seen Zombies, but I know at least one song, the like Do It Like the Zombies Do song, and then the hygienist switched the playlist because she was about to x-ray my mouth and presumably thought that the zombie song would be inappropriate, but I kind of regret not saying like, no, keep it on.
Keep it on. I need this in my ears if I'm going to get through this dental appointment.
But yes, I would say that Halloween is my favorite holiday. I, too, love a Halloween episode. I love sort of the spooky, silly Halloween vibes, which very much is present in every 911 Halloween episode, I would say. Mm-hmm. This one is season 3, episode 6, Monsters, directed by Tina Mabry, who is like a real film and television director. This is the only episode of 911 she ever directed. And this one is written by Christopher Monfette, who of course did Merry Xmas in season 2, Bobby Begins Again, Triggers, and Eddie Begins. Womp womp.
Womp womp. Well, they can't all be hits, so...
Exactly. He's done a couple good holiday episodes, because I remember us liking Merry Xmas. We were mixed on Bobby Begins Again. I honestly don't even remember what we thought of Triggers, even though we recorded it like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I think it was just one of those episodes that just like kind of came and went. And we were happy that it was like back to classic 911 sort of formula. But I think I honestly can't even remember what we thought about that episode. That's the thing about recording this show weekly, is that it just like comes in and out of our brains, right? So yeah. You could tell me something we said like 3 weeks ago and I'd be like, we probably did.
It had Clipboard Buck in it. I remember that.
Oh, yes. I remember being fond of Clipboard Buck, of course.
But shall we just get right... Shall we just jump right into it?
Let's dive right in. Okay. And we begin on a fantastic needle drop of Superstition by the one and only Stevie Wonder. This made me very happy because I'm a very big Stevie Wonder fan. And we open on a shot of a spooky crow.
Very important. We're at like an apple orchard, like sort of a harvest festival kind of thing. I loved this because I just think Halloween, like such an underrated bit of Halloween culture, if you will, is like the apple orchard, the hayride, the corn maze. I love this kind of thing. It's so atmospheric.
Corn maze.
Yeah. And we have a great corn maze in this scene.
We have a great corn maze to this scene. I was getting so thrown back to being a kid in like the where I grew up in Washington was like it was half suburbs. Half a wilderness.
Drink for
and half,
Ryan talking about growing up in Washington.
Half rural farmland. And that rural farmland aspect came into like full swing in Halloween. Because I remember so vividly every year, like we would go to this like, it was this giant property with a huge, there was an outdoor corn maze that you had to be a teenager to get in because it would be scary if you were a little kid and you got lost. So for us little kiddies, there was this indoor hay maze in the top level of this giant warehouse-sized barn. And they played spooky music and there was like ghost like things going on and like laughing clowns and stuff. Like it was terrifying. And so I was just like instantly thrown right back to just being like, oh, my childhood is dead. Oh, no.
Well, it's funny. This scene revolves around two little shit-eating, mischief-making children who are not scared at all.
Yes.
For now. They will be.
For now. it's like this cabal of children tumbling out of a bus, right?
Also known as a field trip.
A field trip, right.
Invading, on a field trip to the apple orchard.
Like bacteria, they are invading this orchard with their presence. And Miss Beckerson is the one thing keeping them in line. I would not fuck with Miss Beckerson. She is in charge, okay? She is keeping these kids in line.
I was thinking as I was watching this, Ryan's going to love this call because of the sort of karmic punishment inflicted upon these two children. But yeah, there are two boys in this class who are clearly the troublemakers. Their teacher is like, you guys better not cause any trouble today. But then, of course, we see this little montage of them making mischief. They're like scaring other kids. They're knocking stuff down.
They mouth off to her by saying, "Oh, we're not gonna cause trouble. We're here to celebrate the harvest and all the cornucopia it provides." And I was like, okay, listen here, you little shit.
Good vocabulary, at least.
Yeah, you may have won the spelling bee, but you watch your back. Okay.
Yeah, they're like tipping over the like artfully arranged pile of little pumpkins. And then they get into the corn maze and they find on top of a scarecrow, a crow. So I guess that scarecrow is not doing a very good job, is it?
Yeah, that crow did not seem very scared.
That crow was like, I have been around the block a few times.
I must say, it needs be remarked that this is reminding me very much of an old classic episode of Bones, right? Do you remember this episode of Bones where it's Halloween time and they're in a corn maze and they find a scarecrow made of a real human skeleton?
Ooh, that sounds like a good one, but I don't remember it.
It was so good. Oh my god, that show was so good. But let's talk about this one. So the crow
that would have been a great ending to this scenario, but no, they find the crow, and like the little shitheads they are, they're like, I'm just gonna start throwing rocks at this bird. Which, you know, not cool. I was just saying in one of our episodes that I love corvids and I would never eat them or do any harm to them. And I do stand by that. And I think this episode, if anything, is such a testament. This episode is like crow-paganda. And I appreciate that about it. So we cut to a 911 call. Quote, the birds, they're going crazy. They're attacking the children.
I don't know if this is like a deliberate, it can't not be on some level, but I do think you have to add the birds to your list of movies 911 has overtly referenced.
Well, they make a few sly references to the birds. Like the 118 shows up next and Chimney says something like, I think I've seen this movie or whatever.
Right. He gets out of the ambulance and syncs up with the rest of the squad, and his name tag unclasps and falls off of his uniform.
His shiny metal name tag.
And Chim versus the Crow begins, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, the Crows are in a frenzy because they've attacked. Chimo.
Sorry, everybody.
The birds are in a frenzy because of the, you know, little shit weasels throwing rocks at them.
Frenzy, another Alfred Hitchcock film.
Hello. I'm getting vertigo just thinking about it.
Oh my God.
Basically, it's a very tense atmosphere, right? Hen is spouting off all these crow facts about how smart they are, how they remember faces.
Classic Hen with the random crow factoids.
Did she have a traumatic experience with a crow as a little girl that just stayed with her and it's become this lifelong obsession? Who's to say?
I mean, it has been a rather consistent thing of her always having knowledge about animals, so I guess you could say she just is particularly interested in animals, but I feel like it's too bad that never comes up as like a larger thing. Like, you know, she doesn't start the show with a pet. She gets that dog at one point, but then we don't really hear about it past season two.
Yeah, whatever happened to that dog? What was it? What was its name again? I can't remember.
Paisley. I think we get like a one-off line in season six that Paisley died. So, you know, kind of a thankless end for Paisley. But it would have been interesting if, I don't know, if maybe you heard once that like when she was growing up, she wanted to be a vet or something, like some kind of explanation for why does she always have the deets on the animals?
Yeah, I'm having like a Mandela effect. I don't know why, but I strangely remember Hen as like wanting to be a vet in like a past life or something like that. I don't know. It's like a weird Mandela moment that I'm having. So the crows they're basically like semi-agitated bears at this point. And so they have to be very careful with their movements. Mm-hmm. No sudden movements. You know, Chimney bends down to like pick up his tag. This crow like menacingly stands in their path. And so they're just like, just leave it. Just leave it. Where it lies in the dirt. We'll get you a new one. It's fine. Instantly, you're thinking, as you're counting off the heads in this scene, you're thinking, where's Buck?
Right. Buck is not present.
But they get past the murder of crows, right? They get past the murder into the barn. And one of the kids is chilling. He's fine. He's, you know, clearly in over his head and regretting all of his life choices. The other one is in worse condition.
Yeah, the one who actually threw the rocks has been bit up by crows. He's not really seriously hurt, but he got cut up by a bunch of crow beaks. So the, you know, Hen and Chimney start tending to him, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to get these kids out, because the crows are kind of like guarding the entrance, because as Hen tells us, crows recognize faces and they hold grudges. So they're thinking that if they try and bring the kids out, the crows will just attack again. So they're like, you know, these crows are expecting two kids. We've got to make it look like they're not two kids. So they like cover the injured one. They cover his face in bandages in a very over the top dramatic way, which I thought was funny. And they put him on the stretcher, and then they put like turnouts on the other little kid to make him look like a very tiny firefighter, and then they get him out.
It's his little Halloween costume. If I was this kid, I wouldn't leave the house for a month, right?
No, and I would be so embarrassed in front of all my classmates that like, oh, I got eaten up by crows on the school field trip. Like, you're never living that down. They're going to call you Crow Boy for the rest of your life.
Crow Boy, the boy that the crows ate instead. He ate his crow while the crows ate him, right?
The crows ate him. But also, yeah, there's the implication that like, what, are the crows just going to remember them forever? And every time they see crows, they will be attacked, which kind of deserved. But
I mean, that'll teach him.
Yeah, that'll teach him.
I feel kind of bad for the kids now. I'm just like, damn, these crows need to understand a little bit of perspective. Like,
well, they're smart enough to do that. They can probably see that these kids have their whole lives ahead of them.
Right, right. They could go to college. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're walking. They're trying to get these kids to safety. And that crow, that pesky little crow from before, is back in that same little spot right in their path. And Chimney, I mean, he's one name tag down. So what does he have to lose? Right. So he gets out a granola bar that he presumably was intending to eat on the ride back.
Right.
Or Chimney. And he just feeds it a little bit, distracts it with some food. I would have expected the rest of the crows to like flock to the spot, but I guess they were like full of like little kid flesh in their bellies.
That they already ate.
that they're like, yeah, you know, like I'm going swimming later. I'm watching my carbs. I can't. But
I'm
you
watching
go,
my crow waistline.
Please, please go for it.
Oh, I'm doing crow keto.
I'm doing crow keto. Keep I'm
crow.
I'm on the paleo crow diet.
All I had for breakfast was a paleo crow muffin. Okay, diet culture is lame in humans, but it's very cute to imagine in crows for some reason.
No, I agree. I agree. It's like, oh, they have a little crow-siety.
Oh, crow-siety. But yeah, but this works. This tactic works.
It works.
The crow gets fed. Nobody's eating crow. Nobody's getting eaten by crow. Now the crow is just eating.
Chimney does seem like he was born to care for an animal. Like, why all of the characters on this show, why does Chimney not have a dog?
Ugh, imagine if after this episode they like made the crow his little pet and he like carries it around on his shoulder and they go on little missions together.
That's Chimney and his crow sidekick. How great. what a world we would live in if Chimney had a crow sidekick.
He would totally name it some like cute movie reference or something.
Mm-hmm.
What would Chimney name his crow?
Oh, you know what he would name it? You know what he would name it? He would name it McFly.
McFly? Oh.
He would name it McFly because it flies.
But I also just had another great idea, which is Russell Crowe.
No, hold on. Buck would name it Russell Crowe. He's that stupid.
Yeah. Okay.
That is 100% what Buck would name it.
You have a scene where they're all discussing what Chimney should name his new crow. And Buck is like, what about Russell Crowe? And everybody's like, no, Buck, that's too stupid and obvious. I'm talking to myself here. And then finally Chimney, he sees his Back to the Future poster that he always keeps in his locker at the fire station. And he thinks, no, I've got it. I'll name you McFly. And then, like you get a little scene every once in a while in an episode where it's like, Chimney, go investigate that area. And he goes over with his little crow buddy and they figure it out together.
But, you know, this would be like an arc. This would be an arc that ends in like, you know, the crow being put in danger or like wanting to fly free and Hen having a heart to heart with him about how this animal wasn't meant to be domesticated. And Chimney has to let it fly free.
Oh, but I want him to have his permanent crow sidekick. But realistically, they probably couldn't afford the crow wrangler for every episode, so they wouldn't keep him there. Which, that was another note I had about this scene, which is, it's kind of amazing to me that presumably they had to get, like, a crow wrangler to source a bunch of trained crows. Because they're not, like, CGI crows.
Yeah, those are real crows.
I'm pretty sure these are all real crows.
Those are very real-looking crows.
Which, of course, they are smart birds, so, you know, I'm sure they are trainable. But I wonder what the behind the scenes of that was like.
I mean, probably pretty expensive on production's part. That's why they,
that's why they had to axe the Chimney Crow buddy cop storyline.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I feel like if they kept the crow around, they would have had to bump him up to, like, recurring cast. Then his salary would have gone up. He'd have to join Equity. It would have been a whole thing.
Now we're basically just making the same joke Jenny Nicholson makes in the Vampire Diaries video about the crow in the Vampire Diaries.
I know. I've been trying to like avoid mentioning that but like that video is so like formative for, I feel like, for both of us, like all of our content like traces lineage back to her channel, and so I was like trying to sidestep
so
it, but
shout
it's
out
like,
to all the crow jokes in the Jenny Nicholson Vampire Diaries video.
Shout out to the spooky crow. Yeah. I think she used that exact verbiage.
Shout out to every spooky crow out there.
Shout out.
But enough about our amazing missed opportunity Chimney Crow storyline. Chimney arrives at the hospital with the ambulance, and, you know, the kid gets wheeled in, and then he sees the crow again. It's like sitting on top of the ambulance. It's stalking Chimney, and he tries to tell Hen, but when he turns back around, before she can see it, the crow has flown away.
We've heard a fluttering noise, but that could mean anything, because it was there one moment and gone the next, right? And so Hen's like, what? What?
Right.
And so it's not just Hitchcock in the sense of the birds, it's Hitchcock in the sense of a psychological thriller where Chimney becomes undone by the constant leering presence of this malignant entity invading his life, inspiring fear and driving him mad. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, the crow is basically gaslighting him throughout the episode.
Literally.
This crow is canceled. Crow is over, party.
If this crow was a real crow, I would log on to X, the Everything app, and cancel that crow.
Hashtag cancel that crow. And we're not talking about Russell.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag see me Norman.
Hashtag see me crow.
See me crow. Hashtag see the crow.
Okay, we are having way too much fun with the crow in this episode. We've only talked about like the first scene.
We've only talked about the crow.
Cut to Bobby and Athena at home. They are setting up an epic Halloween movie night for May and her friends. Bobby's kind of worried about, like, are you sure we want to leave a bunch of teenagers alone in this house? But Athena's like, don't worry. Athena, kind of out of character for her, honestly, to not be kind of type A about this. But she's like, whatever, like, you know, they'll be fine. They're just watching some scary movies.
But I was kind of loving this for Athena, honestly. I was kind of loving this for her because she was like, oh, like, let me step back and give my kids some freedom to enjoy, you know, the work of John Carpenter for an evening. I appreciated that.
Maybe in the wake of her family being brutalized by the police, she's feeling a little more lenient towards her children.
Maybe.
Who knows?
Maybe that's all it took.
But Athena also clocks that Bobby has been stressed out lately. She says he's been stress baking, which I thought was kind of an interesting thing, since we see in season 8, we see Buck start stress baking. So it's like, oh, the father-son relationship there.
The lineage.
But Athena clocks that Bobby is worried about Buck returning to work. His first day back is tomorrow. And Bobby says, you know, Buck signed every waiver imaginable. He says one of my favorite lines in the show, which is, pretty sure we could drop a piano on Buck's head and he wouldn't be able to sue the city for it. I just love that image.
Yeah.
I really do.
I love thinking about that.
Season 9, Buck near-death experience where he gets crushed by a falling piano.
And then he pops at the top with, like, keys in his mouth.
like the strings sticking up all everywhere.
Right, yeah, I love that.
He's like, oh, I'm fine, I survived. But Athena encourages him to not lose sight of the fact that he cares about Buck. And, you know, not be too hard on him, essentially.
And Bobby is still feeling pretty hurt, but, you know, whatever, we're going to leave it on this ambiguous note. And then back at the fire station, who should waltz in for his first day back? Mr. Cock of the Walk over here. I'm so glad to have my job back, Evan Buckley. And who's happy to see him? Oh, that's right.
Nobody.
Nobody.
This is so funny. On the one hand, we did think that Buck was justified in the lawsuit. On the other, it is pretty funny that he like waltzed back into the fire station expecting to be like warmly welcomed back. Yeah. You know, he walks in like, hey man, like what's up with you, guy? And like nobody will even look at him.
Yeah.
He has at the end of the shot, he's like staring forlornly at some guys playing table tennis and ignoring him. I loved it.
Question, do you think he knows these people's names?
Because that's the funny thing is he's not passing any characters we know in this part.
Yeah.
He's passing like extras at the 118. So it's funny to imagine that maybe these people are just not saying hi to him because they're like, "What? We've never talked to you before. Like, we don't know you."
I had a moment of doubt of like, what if he showed up to the wrong shift? Like, none of his regular coworkers are here. And so it would be so funny if like he had genuinely just never like had a conversation with any of these people before. He didn't know their names. And so therefore, why should he expect everyone to know his name or be excited to see him? I guess he's just used to being popular and hot. Right.
He just sort of thought they would all welcome him back regardless.
The ego on this one.
But we cut to him in the glass locker room, And Hen shows up, and she is the mm-hmm. first to actually welcome Buck back. She even got him a little cupcake, which is cute.
Aww.
I'd like to say Buck finally got his cupcake, symbolizing that he's not sad anymore. You guys, the cupcake that he was denied at the cupcakery has finally circled back to him.
Because he was too sad. He's about too Christopher.
Sad. I also thought it was funny that Hen hands it to him and she's like, it's red velvet. It bleeds when you cut it, which obviously is like a Halloween thing, but I'd like to think it's also to honor Buck being on blood thinners.
I'm sorry. I'm still three episodes ago. I have to take back that thing that I said about God. Like you could say anything. And I wouldn't know what you're talking about because I'm still stuck on. He got to the cupcakery.
Because he's too sad.
Because he's too sad.
Listen, you guys, Jane got a little more affected by the THC than she thought she would while recording that episode. And because of it, has pledged not to do that again while recording episodes because it's a little irresponsible. But we did get that moment out of it. And, you know, you're welcome.
But yes, Hen is the first to greet him. The cupcake bleeds, which is funny. Buck asks about, you know, how things are going with Karen. Would love to see a scene with them, but it's fine.
Right? I thought it was kind of weird that in this episode they mention it, but there's no direct follow-up to the very, like, dramatic and emotional thing we witnessed at the end of the previous episode, mm-hmm. where it's revealed that their IVF has not worked, and Karen was very upset about it. Because in this scene, Hen basically just says, like, yeah, it's a long and complicated process. And, like, you know, I wouldn't expect her to necessarily be ready to, like, open up about the entire thing. But, like, we don't even really see that much of a moment of, like, conflict about that within her.
Yeah, it's kind of strange, right? It's like, it's just like, who cares? You know, let's talk about you. But that sort of just leaves that scene on, like, a little, like, weird note of like,
yeah,
no Hen Ren content, it's whatever. And then who should show up at the firehouse for his shift but one Eddie Diaz, looking a little worse for wear.
He is like tired as fuck and he's covered in like scrapes and stuff, and yeah. Buck asks him, dude, are you okay? That's a monster. You'll recall the title of this episode is Monsters.
And what should Eddie do?
He says, just roughhousing with my kid, which is an insane thing to say when you're covered in bruises.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'd hate to see what the child looks like.
Right. Hate to see the other guy. Leans into the mic and says, concerning. It's like, oh, oh.
Buck does have a very funny line in response to that where he says, were you playing with hammers?
Right.
But then Eddie says, nothing you need to be concerned with.
Yeah, just brushes him off. He hates him. Hates him.
Eddie still fully has Buck in the doghouse right now. They are fighting. They are separated. They are on the verge of divorce. The marriage is on the rocks.
Buck is sleeping in the basement. You know, the kids yeah. are going to stay with, like, grandma while they work yeah. this shit out. Eddie right. is, like, you know, he's confiding in his slutty best friend played by Kristen Chenoweth. It's just like,
well, oh, very what, boy next door, I see.
What should I do? Give him head? Like,
yeah, Eddie's like going on double dates with Kristen Chenoweth, right. but nothing's mm-hmm. working out because he still loves his old husband, even though he cheated on him with a lawsuit.
His secretary. A lawsuit, right.
Quote unquote, his secretary named lawsuit.
Chase the ambulance chaser, right. Yeah.
Chase the ambulance. Yeah. Buck has been unfaithful. He's been out and about with Chase the ambulance chaser. But after Eddie leaves, we see from Bobby that Buck is still on like house duty or whatever. He's kind of grounded. Mm-hmm. He's not going out on any calls. Like there's a call. The bell rings, they're supposed to go out on a call, and Bobby's like, you're gonna stay here because you're grounded. So, you know, this sucks for Buck. He is both grounded and in the doghouse in his marriage.
It is not a great time to be Buck.
Yeah, Dad's mad at him and his husband is mad at him.
And everyone at work doesn't know who he is, despite the fact that he doesn't know who they are either. It's so hard to be just a strapping young lad in today's world.
It's so confusing to be a strapping young lad.
It is. You know, we leave Buck looking like a sad dog, you know, whose owner is, you know, going out, leaving him in the house. And then we go from that to just Maddie hanging out with her stalking victim. And it's like, oh, she's driving her home. Oh, her car broke down. I hope Maddie didn't take out the starter.
No, literally, there's a part of you that's like, did Maddie like cut the brakes or something? Right. but Tara, the stalking victim's name is Tara. Tara and Maddie arrive at Tara's house. She is like arguing with her husband on the phone while Maddie unpacks the car. And yeah, we get the details that Tara's car broke down and like her husband bought her this car and is always blaming her when things go wrong with it. Maddie asks to come in and use the bathroom. Good stalker tactic, Maddie.
The amount of stuff that was in the car, by the way. I think, was there a suitcase in there? It genuinely felt like oh, there was stuff in her car because she was gonna leave him or something like that. I don't know. That was the vibe that I was getting, but that might not have been intentional.
I guess like as a trainer, she has a lot of gear. We see like yoga mats and stuff. Yeah. So she loaded it all into Maddie's car.
Yeah, but Maddie invites herself inside to use the bathroom.
First of all, this place is like a crazy LA mansion, like $1 million listing kind of thing.
It's like, it's the most sterile, high class, like Hills joint you could ever see in your life. It is
all the glass walls.
There's no warmth to it. It's kind of appalling, mm-hmm. like how like grossly like rich it is. You know, I don't even think there's any carpeting, right?
I mean, presumably her dumb abusive husband picks out all the decor because he's controlling. Mm-hmm. Tara gets like another call from her husband, and Maddie starts doing that thing that people do in Lifetime movies where she immediately starts like sneakily investigating the house instead of going to the bathroom, which stresses me out so much because she's like going upstairs, looking at their bedroom, like rooting around in the medicine cabinet, and you know she's gonna get caught, and she does, but luckily Tara is just like not weirded out at all, and Maddie is a good liar. She's like, the view up here is just so great, I had to see it. And Tara is like, do you want a drink, girl? And Maddie says yes. And white wine moment.
White wine moment.
They share a little glass of white wine.
Tara says that they didn't have anything to pair it with because they don't really keep food in the house. You know, her horrible husband doesn't like having company, so they never entertain people. And I was thinking, mm-hmm. Well, you totally have something to pair it with because Maddie found oxycodone in the medicine cabinet. You guys could have a great night.
Great idea. Right? Great idea.
And Maddie sort of relates this idea of like the isolating husband that doesn't like to have guests over to his house back to her experiences with Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And in kind of a subtle way. She doesn't come out of it being like, my husband abused me. She's more subtly being like, you know, my husband was the same way and I left him, right?
Yeah, she's like, she's dropping hints that Tara should leave her husband. She's kind of planting the seeds, seemingly trying to do sort of a psychological thing on Tara to get her to start thinking about the idea that it would be okay to leave.
Well, it seems like, Maddie, like, you know, Tara asks her sort of like, how did you get through that? Because she's curious about Maddie's mm-hmm. like experience of leaving her husband for obvious reasons. And Maddie tells her that, you know, she had the support of her friends, of her family. You know, I'm sure you can, you know, relate to some of that. And it's like Tara's reaction, judging by it, it's like clear that her husband is like very much like in the process of like socially isolating her. She doesn't have anyone else other than him and her job. It's a very common abuse tactic. Mm-hmm. And it paints a pretty bleak picture of this whole situation. But Tara like sort of asks like, but you got out of it, you know, and you're free of him. And as a viewer, you're like thinking back to like how horrible and violent that even like the leaving him was. And like you're just like praying that this woman doesn't have to go through the same thing, because like what Maddie went through is like probably like the pinnacle of like, you know, that scenario, right? Mm-hmm. It's like kind of worst case scenario where you still make it out relatively okay. Well, as okay as Maddie is, right? Which is contested.
True. Well, on that note, I think what they're also doing in this scene is when they have Tara say, like, now you're free of him or whatever, And then we kind of linger on Maddie's face. I think a big part of the storyline is like, by engaging in this kind of unhealthy obsessive behavior of like stalking this woman, it's clear that she has not gotten over this situation yet. So I think that's, there's like a little bit of irony there as well.
Yeah. And so when she assures Tara that, like, you know, she did and she's proof that there's always a way out, she's like saying it for Tara and also kind of for her as well. She's it's sort of a self-assurance as well as an assurance for Tara that there is a way out, if that is something that she needs, which, is, of course, as we know, she does.
But on that note, we cut to an epic REO Speedwagon needle drop.
Yeah, remember when we said this was going to be a lighter episode?
You know, it sort of just does that classic thing we love about 911, where it just veers dramatically between both extremes in a totally crazy and unpredictable way. So now we've got a woman driving. She's on the phone. She's picking up things for a party, we hear. And as she's driving, she almost hits like a cyclist, swerves, and actually hits a pedestrian who goes straight through the windshield, and she hits her head. And in her hitting her head stupor, she like has lost the ability to even notice that the guy is in her windshield. So she just keeps driving. And this is, of course, based on a very famous real life case. In 2001, there was a woman who murdered a homeless man in a similar manner. She hit this guy. He went through the windshield. He was stuck in there. And she just returned to her garage like nothing happened. And the man didn't die until like 2 to 3 days later. But there's a movie based on this from like 2007 or something. It's Stuart Gordon and it's called Stuck. So I feel like we have to watch it.
So one of the Patreons recommend that next time this month. That'll be your recommendation. We watch Stuck.
We can watch Stuck. But in real life, it was kind of a more bleak story, both in the sense that the guy died versus in this episode, the guy survives. And also, in the real life situation, you know, the woman was like intoxicated when it happened, but it sounds like after that, like her actions were totally deliberate. She was aware that this guy was in her car and she kind of, rather than dealing with the situation, decided to let him die and then try to cover it up. So pretty bleak story in real life.
Which is horrible, but also a very interesting angle for like a narrative if they went down that path. This narrative that they've chosen with this character is more in line with the tone of the show overall. It's very fantastical. Basically, she hits her head and, like you said, falls into this like sort of like dull haze of sort of like disorientation where she's just like, you know, autopilot drives home, parks her car, and, you know, it for the rest of the episode basically remains sort of blissfully unaware that there's even anything amiss going on, right? And so it's like, it's totally not her fault, in a sense.
Yeah, no, this episode very much, like, removes any culpability from this woman.
Which is, like, I do think it is kind of a shame, just because I do enjoy morally gray characters in that sense. Well, not even morally, just, like, morally contemptible characters that are, like, in scenarios like this where they get down further and further into this thing and they spiral, and that's always fun to watch.
Well, it sounds like maybe you'll like the Stuart Gordon film Stuck.
I feel like I would, but then like at the same time, like it also kind of feels like disrespectful to go that angle considering this was based on a real event that actually happened and a guy actually died. So I'm like, I don't know. Maybe we lucked out that they decided to go the lack of culpability route with this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a little less interesting to take away any responsibility from her, but I would imagine that, like, because they chose to just have this be, like, kind of a minor, like, running thread in the episode versus, like, focusing a whole episode on it, they probably just didn't feel like they had time to do the whole, like, complex character study of the lady who decides to leave the guy to die in her car.
That would have been great if it was Buck that got hit, and it's always Buck. If Buck was the one that got hit through the windshield,
that
and
would
like,
be
and
crazy.
She that would be the ultimate NDE. That would be like, that'd be the number one. And Eddie's the one that finds him. And it's very, very dramatic. And then Buck makes it out alive, and they kiss. Right. and that woman goes to jail.
I feel like they wouldn't do that, if anything, because they would consider it, like, too humiliating to have Buck, like, stuck in a windshield for an entire episode. Then again, likely thing for him to do.
Likely thing for him to do. And also, just, like, how funny would that be? Like, of course it's him funny. That gets in that situation. Of course it is.
It would be funny, but you know, with this show, whenever Buck gets hurt, they want to take it seriously, so...
It's like, why? Just hurt him. Sorry. I feel so...
Just have the piano fall on his head.
No, I don't... I have to do some self-reflecting about what it is about, like, me, but also seemingly everyone else, that we seem to just love putting this man in peril and, like, mortal danger and seeing him in pain.
Yeah, I mean, it's Wump, you know? It's the oldest fanfic trope in the book.
Yeah, it's Wump. It is. I love me some Wump, especially with a silly, goofy boy like Buck. What can I say?
Exactly.
I make no apologies for it. Oliver Stark, come on our podcast.
Come on our podcast. But we go from that to Maddie and Chimney at the mall, and they've just seen the movie Halloween. They're discussing the Halloween series lore, which I love for them. They're talking about, like, I thought, you know, he was her brother. And then it's like, no, that was actually a retcon from Halloween 2. So Maddie's like, what happens in Halloween 3? And Chimney's like, nothing to do with Michael Myers, because, of course, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, or whatever it's called, was, like, meant as a standalone sequel, and they were thinking about doing a whole, like, anthology thing with the franchise, but then
which would have been so cool, which would have been so cool if they did that, and they didn't do it, and I'm still kind of pissed about it, I'm not gonna lie, because I love Season of the Witch, and I really like the direction that it was heading, but they pivoted back because nobody liked it. I could totally see, if this date didn't get interrupted, them going back home and loading up YouTube on, like, the big TV, just, like, watching Halloween lore videos to try and connect all the dots. Like, I could totally see them being that kind of couple, you know what I mean?
Totally. But unfortunately, their evening is spoiled a little when they run into Tara and Vincent, her abusive husband. And through doing this, you know, it might have been okay if all that was revealed here was like, oh, Maddie's been going to the gym and got a trainer without telling me. But unfortunately, Tara says, like, when she finds out Chimney's a paramedic, she's like, oh, a paramedic and a nurse, like, how perfect. And so that informs Chimney that Maddie has been dishonest with this woman. And after they leave, Chimney's like, what is going on here? Like, what was that all about? Maddie reveals her dastardly plan to Chimney.
Can we talk about how much J-Love is serving in this scene? She is serving
literally
so hard in this scene. Her hair is windswept. She looks radiant. And she has
she
this, like, discontent
really
look on her. She has this, like, discontent look on her that, like, she's just, like,
she's good
caught.
At that.
It's, like, it's so good. Like, I was just, like, I was fangasming out over here about, like, Miss Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Yeah, and she's doing good acting here, too. But she reveals the dastardly plan. You can really see that, like, she's rationalizing it. Like, to her, this is all justifiable. But Chimney is the first to finally be like, okay, you're being crazy.
Yeah, he's the only person who's seen this from an outsider's perspective with, like, a full, like, view of what's going on. And it's like, no, this is unhinged. You are acting like this is out of character for you. Something's going on. What's going on, Maddie?
He actually says something very cutting, which is he says, you're acting just like Doug, because this was kind of similar to what Doug did to Chimney by pretending to be, like, a stranger and befriending him. I do think he went too far by saying that, but he acknowledges that later.
Yeah, he does acknowledge that to his credit. I will say it did almost feel kind of out of character for Chimney to have that gap in his judgment of, like, let me invoke Doug in this situation. I was very put off by that. I'm not going to lie.
Yes, their actions were technically comparable, but, like, I feel like Chimney would know not to, like, compare Maddie to her abuser, like, to her face or at all. It's it feels a little weird.
What's the one thing you don't do to a survivor of abuse?
To an abuse victim.
You're just like him. Wow.
Like, that's crazy. Yeah, so that upsets Maddie, understandably. And he does try to kind of, you know, he's like, I'm sorry, that was harsh, but, like, you need to tell.
He tries to soften it. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, you need to tell Tara the truth. Like, what, no matter what, that needs to happen.
Because he is generally correct in this, like, in this encounter, mm-hmm. like that, you know, she can't really help her by lying to her in this sense that her dishonesty yeah. is no, just going to make the situation correct. Worse and messier. He was just wrong for that.
It was just an out of pocket thing to say on that one front for sure.
Yeah.
Again, we cut away from that extremely serious moment to Bobby assigning Buck candy duty at the fire station.
He's Maddie at the candy counter selling the $100,000 bar. Bobby is like giving him like a very serious rundown of like the candy station. There's like this line of candy apples that look delicious, and there's this blue
Bobby
bin
runs that candy station that like
specifically
the Navy.
For dietary restrictions, so gluten-free, no nuts, no soy, no whatever, the blandest sounding candy you can imagine, but I guess it's good for kids, so that's good.
Just like apple slices or something.
But even blander than that is a collection of smoke detectors for the parents.
Yeah, Buck holds one up and he's like, he says, are these for the kids who are allergic to fun?
Yeah.
Bobby says, like, no, those are for the parents.
Buck is obviously very, like, you know, discontent with the fact that, you know, he's been stuck on desk duty, essentially. He's, you know, given all this light work, even though his agreement was that he wouldn't be given light work and all that. Mm-hmm. And Bobby tells him, he tells him something very interesting, which is one day, I'm paraphrasing here, one day you're going to stop being so hot-headed and learn some patience. I hope we're both alive to see it.
He says one day you'll learn to stop pushing and learn some patience.
I hope we're both alive to see it.
Ooh. Does he know?
Does he know?
Well, at least, you know, it's been long enough that we can laugh about it. Just kidding. We were laughing about it when it happened.
Yeah.
I guess Buck did learn some patience before Bobby died, we could say.
Mm-hmm. And Bobby was alive to see that, so that's good. we see as Bobby leaves, we see Buck, he tries to like swipe some of the candy, right? And Chimney comes over and he has to put it back.
Oh, he can't even have candy because he's too sad.
But Chimney over here is like showing some solidarity. Like, you know, the first few months I worked here, the only time I saw outside of those doors was at the beginning and end of my shifts. Buck's like, how did you get through it? He said, by cleaning everything until it shined like the top of the Chrysler building. I learned my patience through true grit and hard work, and you can too. Buck is being a prissy little princess about this. He is very, like, sort of indignant at the idea of having to do hard work and earn his way back into the respect of his peers, which I found very funny.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you hear Chimney call back to, like, the Chimney Begins thing, where, yeah, he just didn't get to see any action for, like, the first couple of months, presumably, that he was on duty, it kind of makes you think, like, okay, maybe Bucky is being a little dramatic that on his first shift he doesn't get to do anything. His first shift
he needs some
back.
Perspective. Wow, Buck complaining as a white man about how hard it is to be put on light duty, it really makes you think, you know, think, check your privilege, Buck Buckley.
Check your privilege, Buck. Buck realizes that his lesson is also to suck it up and be patient. So he kind of puts on a happy face. He's like, I may not be happy about it, but I'm going to do my darndest at all this. And Chimney also asks him if he's talked to Maddie today. And Buck's like, no, why? And Chimney's like, just wondering. But, you know, that makes Buck a little curious. Buck walks away. Chimney sees the crow again. And he kind of confronts it. He's like, are you a good omen or a bad omen? Because the old wives seem divided on this. But then just as Chimney tries to get a passing Eddie to also look at the crow flies away again before Eddie can see it. So it still is gaslighting Chimney. It's still canceled.
No, it needs be remarked. This is where we start to see Chimney's sanity start to slip, because we don't even hear the sound of like a feathers, you know, being being rustled as it takes flight and goes to hide this time. It's just gone. It just vanishes. it vanishes into you.
Yeah, we can't be sure if this crow is real or if Chimney is just going crazy.
Right. And Eddie doesn't see it.
We go back to our head injury woman. She wakes up the next day. This guy is still in her car, in her garage. We see she's got this huge goose egg on her head, which I guess maybe she like lives alone and nobody has noticed that she's clearly injured. So she gets into her car and still doesn't realize that the guy is there. There's a funny moment where she kind of looks at him and she's like, oh my God, I forgot the shopping list or whatever. Right.
My list, of course. I completely forgot my list and nothing else, right?
Nothing else. And then we cut to this family like sitting outside at a taco shop, and they're observing various Halloween car pranks and decorations. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, somebody's got a little fake bloody arm sticking out of their trunk.
The daughter of this family is indignant. She is talking about, she's in like her Tumblr social justice phase. She's talking about how like Halloween decorations glorify violence, and it's like reinforcing.
It's not even like cool social justice. It's basically like violent video games are bad social justice.
It's
perpetuating a culture of, you know, desensitized to violence. It's like, girl, it's Halloween.
Well, it's like a young person who's trying to be socially conscious but hasn't like yet learned that you can't be mad about everything, right? And so she's just like,
I mean, you can,
well, I guess you can, but and so she's just like
but
pointing
your family
out like
might get annoyed at you for it. But so these people are observing all these Halloween decorations, so when the woman with the man in her windshield drives by, they're kind of primed to think it's just a decoration. Mm-hmm. But then the parents see the guy move and decide to call 911. Luckily, they call Maddie. They're like describing the situation, and she's like, are you sure it's not a decoration? But they're like, no, we're pretty sure we saw him move. Like, at least go send somebody to check it out. So she does.
That image of the guy in the windshield is so, like, I'm surprised that hasn't become more iconic, like as a reaction image or something, because like it is like visceral, like looking at it, like how like realistic it looks and how like unintentionally hilarious it is. It's like it's
I mean,
this
it is a real thing that like led to the real death of a real man.
I know I shouldn't be making jokes about it, but it looks so funny
on a TV show.
This car driving down the street, and it's just this guy head first in the windshield. But
well, we
no,
see
Maddie
at work.
Yeah. She handles it, right? Mm-hmm.
She handles it, and she's wearing the laziest costume ever. She's wearing like a shirt that says, I'm a cat, and some little like, you know, dollar store cat ears.
Yeah, the kitty ears and the shirt that says, I'm a cat. And she's on the phone with like police dispatch, and she is like not in the mood to banter with anyone. She's like, I have this report about this car. And they're like, are you sure this is real? And you can see her like rolling her eyes, and she's like, yes, go. I'm
she's
sending
like, find
you
out for me, bitch.
Find out for me. Jesus Christ. The week I have had, okay?
Yeah,
and
these
Josh
fucking
comes
loser
over.
Pigs.
Josh comes over. Like basically dripping doubloons with a parrot on his shoulder,
dressed in a crazy pirate costume. Yeah, he's got the parrot on his shoulder.
Most swashbuckling ass motherfucker you've ever heard in your life.
Covered in ruffles.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
He looks great.
It's iconic. It's iconic. If there's one person who's going to go out all out on Halloween, it's going to be Josh, okay? Because he comes over and he's talking about all the dud calls he's gotten so far, and you're just looking at him and you're like, "Wow. What's underneath?" Sorry, that's me.
Sorry.
He has a hook hand. He went all out for this, and we find out later that he's going to three different Halloween parties before midnight. I'm like,
oh my God. Yeah.
I can't tell you about the first or the second, but I can tell you about the third. Okay. And I can definitely tell you about the fourth.
Okay. But back at the station.
Buck is manning the candy counter.
Buck is being the least enthusiastic candy distributor ever. He's handing out candy to kids like he's on the factory assembly line in 1917.
Yeah, and this one kid dresses like a jailbird or whatever. He comes over. He tries to grab a handful. Buck says there's a two candy maximum, and this kid just like tears into him. He just eviscerates Buck. Like
the kid asks him, like, what are you dressed as? And Buck says, a firefighter. And he says, then how come you're not out fighting fires?
Right.
Not what Buck needs to hear right now.
And then the fire truck comes back and he goes, Mom, look, the real firefighters are here.
Ooh, that it's just devastating. Crushed Buck's ego. Yeah. Death for Buck in a bad way.
Oh my goodness. And of course, Eddie still hates him. Eddie hates him, right?
Yeah. Buck passes Eddie and he asks him if he like wants to give him a hand with the candy. And Eddie says, no, you got it. You're 100%. Lawsuit proved that, right? At this point, I wrote in my notes, he's being so annoying. Because you guys, as much as I appreciate like the kind of catty, dramatic buddy stuff in this episode, I do ultimately think Eddie is like totally overreacting. I do get that the lawsuit was unfortunate for everyone, but I think Eddie, and I also realize that Eddie canonically has anger issues at this point, but I feel like the episode frames it like Eddie's kind of in the right here. I just think he's being like such a little pissy baby about it the whole episode. And I don't really think it's deserved. So that's my one Eddie dislike quota for the episode.
Well, and we'll get to like the reconciliation, but I also thought that was really unearned.
I agree.
But I totally agree. And like, it was annoying watching because I'm like, I'm all here for like a buddy divorce era, but I need it to be justified a little bit more than just like Eddie is unjustifiably more pissed off than anyone else. And like, obviously, if you read into it that like he's pissed off because he's in love with Buck, then sure.
Right, he takes it more personally because his relationship to Buck is more personal than the others.
But there's nothing in the text that supports that, right?
Right, and his actual anger, and like the source of it, seems kind of unjustified.
Yeah, but we get this trick-or-treat montage at this guy's house. This guy is just like a regular suburban dad. Set to
an Oingo Boingo needle drop. Just so you all know.
This is going to be huge for my best friend, Amy. Amy, if you're listening, I know you are Oingo Boingo's biggest fan. And so this one's
Oingo
for you.
Oingo Boingo pill.
No, genuinely, she is Oingo Boingo's biggest fan. And so I just know this is huge for her.
There are like some young people who are into that. And I say more power to them.
Yeah, Danny Elfman is coming back in a big way. And I'm happy to see it. I think he is a talent. Unless he has I don't think he does. But just in case, covering my ass.
Let's just not go there.
Yeah. but there's this trick or treat montage at this guy's house. And he's a regular suburban dad, you know, one of those guys that you like, you know, just a regular guy you run into in a house doing Halloween. And he is opening a door for all this like these groups of kids, you know, zombies and princesses and mummies and shit like that. And he eventually opens the door and it's just the most emaciated looking little girl you've ever seen in your entire life. The special effects and makeup on this girl is insane.
She's credited in this episode as Wraith-like girl. So that's just what I'm going to call her. She is Wraith-like. Yeah, she comes to the door. The man obviously assumes she's in costume at first, but then he kind of sees that she's got this, like, she's kind of also in a stupor, like she can't really speak. And he looks down and she's got like a handcuff attached to her wrist. And then she passes out. So clearly something's wrong. He like calls for his wife or whatever.
It is LA. And I was very surprised this guy just didn't assume that this girl was just like a really good actress who takes her craft really seriously.
Oh.
And so she's like embodying the character of this wraith-like girl. And she's like,
he calls his wife, but instead of being like, help me, he's like, hey, we've got another stupid actor on our doorstep.
They're like, oh, patronizing applause for the little girl.
Right. Send her along with a few dollars for acting school, for gas money to her auditions.
You see this little girl like pass out and him catch her. And then like you just instantly know, okay, so this is how Angela's going to earn her paycheck this episode. Got it.
Oh, yeah. But before that, we go to Maddie and Josh at work again. And Josh, this is when Josh says he's got three parties to hit before midnight. I love his delivery here. I forget exactly how he does it, but he just does it in a very, like, fun way.
In a very gloaty way. He, like, jokingly asks if she's jealous, and she very realistically is like, No, I want to go home. Like, yeah. I don't want to party.
After this, like, long-ass 911 dispatcher shift, you're going to 3 parties before midnight. But you know what? That's Josh. He likes to party, I guess. I kind of like this bit of Josh characterization we're getting.
I have coworkers like this who will work a double, like getting up at, like 8 in the morning, come to the restaurant, work a double, will hang out after their shift is over, and then, like, go out and party until 4 a.m., and then open the next day. I'm like, how do you have the energy?
I could never.
I go home, I watch TV, and I'm like, you know?
But, Sue is looking for Maddie. We hear that from Josh. Rutro, mm-hmm. The boss is on her case. And Rutro. Maddie, like, goes to kind of outside Sue's office, and she sees Tara. Tara is here, and she's filing a complaint. The cat's out of the bag, and Maddie's dressed as a cat. The Maddie cat is out of the bag. Mm-hmm. Tara has figured out everything, and she starts kind of taking Maddie to task. Maddie tries to explain herself, tries to kind of relate about the abusive husband situation, but Tara is still really resistant to this. I mean, she has a right to be like, even if you are right, mm-hmm. what you did, like the way you went about this was totally inappropriate. But she starts to kind of do the like, I'm not one of those women things.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, it's an interesting bit of character work that we see in this scene, because like Tara, you know, like you said, she has this like instinctual sort of defensiveness of like, I'm not one of those women. And instead of like getting like defensive about that or like offended, like, you know, Maddie would necessarily have like a right to be, instead she sort of relates to that mm-hmm. instinctual reaction, because she had that same thing, she talked about it with Athena, that sort of judgment. And so she uses that to put herself in Tara's shoes and to try and empathize with her. And even then, you know, Tara is still unwilling to meet her there, because she's still in denial about what's happening to her.
I mean, again, understandably, because of the way Maddie stalked her, because Tara ends this by saying, like, stay away from me and my husband. And as Maddie's kind of watching her go dejectedly, Sue materializes behind Maddie in a witch costume, which is hilarious. She like takes off her witch hat, because mm-hmm. presumably that would be inappropriate for the tenor of meeting they're about to have.
Could you imagine?
She calls Maddie in for a talk.
Could you imagine? She calls Maddie in for the talk, and the entire time she's wearing an obnoxiously large witch hat.
Yeah. Oh my God. I wish they hadn't had her take it off. And then she ends the meeting and she's like, oh,
oh. Oh, whoa.
But,
yeah. But we go back to the hospital, and of course, Athena Grant is there.
Wraith-like girl
is in the hospital. Athena Grant is on the scene. The doctor is giving her the rundown. Essentially, this girl has been through hell. She's emaciated. She's dehydrated. Mm-hmm. She's
been, like, systemically malnourished.
And shackled as well, like, at her wrists and her mm-hmm. ankles. Very grisly scene. And so Athena asks, you know, about, like, the bottoms of her feet. Like, how far does it seem like she ran? Were there cuts? Was there bruising? And she goes, no, there's just dirt. So instantly you think it was a neighbor. It was one of the neighboring mm-hmm. houses. She couldn't have gotten that far before she found her way to someone's house. Right? That makes sense.
Yeah. So we go to Athena, like, directing officers. They're back in the neighborhood where this girl was discovered. And she's directing mm-hmm. officers to do a search for, like, anything unusual. And, of course, one officer points out it'll be kind of hard to ask people if they've seen anything unusual since it's Halloween. Like, of course they have. So mm-hmm. Athena kind of gets a light bulb moment. And she's like, we should be searching not for anything out of the ordinary, but for all the houses that aren't decked out for Halloween, all the ones that aren't feeling the spirit of the season or
whatever.
It's
smart, because you'd look for mm-hmm. a house in that scenario that's not trying to draw attention to itself. A house that looks like, you know, that's like that. It's a very smart way of thinking that kind of like is genuine light bulb moment, and it makes you go, oh shit, that's right. Yeah.
Maybe she is a good cop. Oh wait. But yeah, you can't imagine that the local kidnapped children house is, like, getting super into Halloween decorating.
Right, that'd be weird, right? And so they start canvassing, and they find this fucking Michael Myers house. They find this, like, it's totally so dark, no lights on, looks completely abandoned. Athena stumbles her way into the backyard and finds, that the girl also had shards of glass in sort of the cuts on her forearms. Mm. We find this door. The back door has a broken window.
And the windows on the back door are also, like, newspapered over.
Yeah. It's, like, clear. They don't want anyone seeing inside, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she enters the house. And it's, like, one of those TV houses that you can, like, smell through the screen, you know?
Yeah. Athena discovers a very dirty, very messy, but apparently empty house. She's kind of going through every room. She's not finding much.
There's this lingering sort of ambient ADR flies sound effect that was reminding me a lot of that episode of Teen Wolf where Lydia was plagued by flies that turned out to be electricity.
Oh,
remember that
one?
A classic. That's when we discovered Kira's lightning powers. For all of our Teen Wolf listeners, of which I'm sure we have a plurality.
All of our true alphas out there.
All of our true alphas out there. Subscribe to Jane's Patreon. and mine whenever I get around to making it. I have to finish my new video first.
Subscribe to any number of Patreons that will give us money.
And Jenny Nicholson as well, because we love her.
Right.
But Athena, she's sort of stumbling through the house. It's very gross, very covered in trash and unwashed dishes. And she hears a cough. Right? She hears it. She hears a distant, faraway cough that seems to be coming from the bowels of the earth. So she finds
the
door.
Basement of the house.
Well, that's, well, we said the same thing. She finds a door leading with the staircase leading downward. And so she follows it, Skinamarink style.
It appears to be some sort of subterranean room in the house. Perhaps one could call it a basement.
Right. A dwelling of sorts.
But she goes downstairs and she has a wonderful line where she says, "Holy Mother of God," shout out season 8. And she finds a whole host of imprisoned, emaciated children. Like, this girl was not the only one. There are, like, 10 of them.
Yeah. And so instantly you think, okay, this is a child trafficking operation. Okay, these, you know, young girls are
like
being,
that.
Like, moved and sold and whatnot. And it's grisly
and
awful.
Yeah, I was thinking about, because I'm not, like, a huge true crime person, but I've you know, watched some documentaries like the rest of them. I've listened to some podcasts. I'm
You've
familiar
seen Taken.
With, like, a lot of the famous... Right. I have seen Taken. I'm familiar with a lot of the, like, famous kind of cases, and I was trying to think, like, what this might have been, if anything, directly inspired by. At first, when it was just the girl, I was thinking, is this a Joseph Fritzl thing, where, like, he had, I think, his daughter chained up in the basement?
I mean, any number of, like, episodes of Law and Order, right? Like,
yeah, it might be kind of an amalgamation of a bunch of different cases, but it, for all I know, maybe there's, like, a direct one. But yeah, there have been kind of a lot of famous cases of, like, kids being, like, abused in such a way where they're, like, locked up in the basement or whatever, or
child
never
abuse.
Really get to see the outside
Don't do
world.
It.
Well, yes.
Right.
Yes, I would agree.
And then, so they're taking, I almost said they're taking the kids to jail. They're not. They're taking the kids to the hospital to be.
That would be a classic Athena move.
You're all trespassing.
You're all under arrest.
Athena, she, you know, Holy Mother of God's the kids up to the street and into various ambulae. And who should show up to the house but the... fire and brimstone preaching parents of this suburban LA neighborhood, right?
First, we get a few little nuggets of information from, you know, Eddie. The whole 118 is here, other than Buck, RIP. Eddie says they found, like, canned food and Bibles and textbooks all from the 1950s. So this seems like maybe some kind of, like, culty, like, isolationist kind of thing. And then Hen says she heard from one kid that they weren't abducted. These were all siblings who live here and their parents did this to them, which, like, I don't want to call Hen naive necessarily, but I don't know. Once we found that there were other kids in the basement, my mind kind of immediately went to, like, this is probably one of those, like, fucked up parental abuse situations.
That's interesting because my mind went to sex trafficking. So I guess we just were oriented in different ways.
We have different true crimes on the brain. Yeah.
Right. But like, you know, you hear like the thing about the 1950s and you're like, oh my God, these kids, they won't even know about Milosevic. They won't even know about the Clinton administration. Who's going to teach them all of these things?
I wonder, do you think they got out and like somebody was using a cell phone and they were like, ah, what's that?
What's
sorry
that?
To make light of the child abuse storyline in this
what's
episode.
That oh my God, they got Bin Laden. Who's Bin Laden? Like
but we wait, a what crashed into the World Trade Center?
But wait, but there were twin towers, what?
But yes, like you said, the parents show up and they're like acting very boldly, just being like the concerned parent act, you know? They're yeah. like, we've been looking for our daughter everywhere. I don't know if like, I mean, presumably to be this abusive of a parent, you would have mm-hmm. to like have some things going on yourself. Like you would not be a rational person. So maybe they truly think that their actions are justified and not crazy to other people.
I guess, but we don't really get any meaningful psychoanalysis of these people. So like no. the best that we can like go off of is that these parents seem completely under the impression that what they're doing is fine and normal, actually. And they seem right. genuinely surprised when Athena says, you are going to prison. You are yeah. under arrest for many crimes.
Yeah, Athena arrests them for mm-hmm. many crimes. So at least finally, that's the end of that.
Finally, people arrested that deserve it, right?
Right, right. Some okay policing in this episode, I guess. Mm-hmm. We go back to Maddie talking to Sue, getting her stern talking to from Sue. Sue has like investigated all the 911 calls that Tara made. She is kind of grudgingly excusing Maddie's actions as coincidence for like the official record. But then she kind of starts giving Maddie her talking to. She's like attributing Maddie's actions to trauma and burnout from both the job and Maddie's prior experience in life, basically. And mm-hmm. so she schedules Maddie for a psychological assessment. And Maddie's like, what? Like, I'm not due for one until next year or whatever. But Sue's like, girl, you are getting that assessment now. And she tells her to schedule a session with the counselor. And she's like, that is not a suggestion. So good on Sue for forcibly telling people to go to therapy.
I understand how Maddie could end up in like a situation where she like, you know, instinctively is like, what? I don't need this. I'm totally normal and well adjusted. But if I may make a suggestion to one Maddie Buckley, when your boss is explicitly laying out for you how she's going to let you off the hook for this horrible thing that you've mm-hmm. been doing, in association with your workplace that implicates everyone involved.
Right.
If she tells you that you need to get a psych eval, that you need to schedule a session with the counselor, girl, just shut the fuck up and do it. Like,
yeah, honestly, the time for arguing has passed.
Yeah. Just sit down and listen. And at the end, don't even say, okay, just nod. Just nod.
But we go back to the station and Hen is watching the news about the abusive parent situation and Bobby comes up and joins her. And Hen says she's kind of thinking about her and Karen's relationship with Denny and how, you know, sometimes they joke about wanting to lock him up, like wanting to kind of be overprotective of him. But that she's realized that really, you know, that kind of overprotection and sheltering is really not for the child's benefit, but for the parents. And Bobby realizes that she's making a pretty unsubtle comparison between this and Buck and Bobby's situation.
Okay, I understand the narrative utility of linking it into the Buckby storyline, but if I may, missed opportunity mm-hmm. ding, because like Hen's entire storyline right now is about giving Denny a sibling, and we just had right. like a whole episode about like varying sibling dynamics and how those affect Hen. Would not seeing a group of 10 or so emaciated, neglected, abused children, siblings, if you will, have any sort of implication on this sort of seemingly traumatizing IVF process that she and Karen are going through.
Yeah, once again, it feels a little weird that they sort of gloss over like the dramatic beat that happened there in the previous episode when, it does feel like it would at least stir up some emotions in Hen, maybe beyond just being like, wow, I would never do that to my child.
When you see Hen like looking dejected watching the TV, you'd think this would like lead into like some sort of like inspiring, some sort of like demoralizing, like with the idea of like having another kid, right? Or like it would at least like give her something to play with the topic. But no, I guess we're just doing Buck and Bobby again.
It's Buck and Bobby time.
Like we have been. Okay. I'm clamoring. Yeah. I am clamoring for them to bring at least one Hen Ren to the narrative forefront. Okay. Just one for one arc, please. For one arc. She's main cast. Yeah.
Right. It feels a little unfortunate, but Hen keeps waxing poetic about Buck's thing he's going through. Bobby's like, you think I'm being too hard on Buck, and Hen's like, I think Buck makes everything hard on Buck. You know, he has two settings, zero and shut up before I smack you. At first I thought she was saying that like Buck makes everything hard on Buck, like he's already beating himself up about it, but no, apparently she meant he acts out and gets people to be hard on him.
Which is interesting, but I think it's also true because downstairs, Buddy divorce is happening even more. Buddy divorce. Because
Buck is putting away Halloween decorations and he runs into Eddie and he decides to confront Eddie about ignoring him. He has a great line where he says, you're just going to keep ghosting me because Halloween is over, just so you know. Epic burn, Buck. You really got him.
Epic burn.
And we get this beautiful shot with like Buck and Eddie on opposite sides of the frame, separated by like this thing separating them, out of focus in the foreground. And they've got like different colored backgrounds based on the two places that they're standing. Wonderful little shot for this usually pretty normally shot show.
I'm surprised they haven't seen more of this shot in fan edits and fan cams, because it does seem like a sort of a quintessential Buddy trouble shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Buddy struggle shot.
But, you know, Buck is expressing like, you know, I don't want anything from you. I just want you to talk to me, like even if it's just to say you're still mad. And Eddie starts ripping into him. He's like, you never considered what this lawsuit could do to us, which is interesting because it's not super clear at first if Eddie means us, the rest of the 118, or us, Eddie and Buck. I think he's talking about the rest of the 118, but it kind of sounds like he's saying like us, our relationship that we have together.
Yeah, that could mean nothing.
That could mean nothing, right?
Right.
And Eddie is still accusing Buck of not considering that his actions affect the rest of them. And yeah, here again, you know, I still think Buck was justified for the lawsuit, and I kind of feel like Eddie is the one being childish and selfish about it. And again, I get that he is actively going through his anger issues arc, but it's a little annoying that the show doesn't seem to see it as, like, Eddie being unreasonable here. And, like, I get having them have, like, a manufactured divide here, but it doesn't feel super earned, like you said.
Yeah, I agree. I understand like sort of like the narrative like sense of like having these characters be at odds with each other, right? And I do get annoyed generally when I see things like people saying like sort of like assigning sort of like a moral value to like fights between characters, interpersonal conflicts, etc. But when you talk about things like framing, right? When you talk about things like the show taking sides itself or approving of one side more than the other, like this is an example of that, right? Like in this conversation, Eddie is like strangely being framed as like sort of like uniformly justified in his anger at Buck, and there's given no voice really to Buck's perspective because Eddie never sits with Buck's perspective. He never does any work to meet Buck halfway. It's just Buck, I guess, bending the knee to Eddie's way of, you know, looking at things and apologizing and Eddie forgiving him. You know, like like it's nothing, and it's like, well, that feels kind of unearned. I'm sorry, it just does, you know?
Yeah, and once again, it's kind of that thing of just the whole lawsuit arc not really feeling satisfying because it feels like not enough people ever really, yeah, like, validate the feeling that Buck had about not being able to work anymore. And, you know, we see, like, Hen being sympathetic to him the whole time, but it kind of feels like on both Bobby and Eddie's fronts that they never truly, like, met him where he was at and said, like, okay, I hear you about this, before, like, being angry about it and, like, demanding an apology or whatever. And so, like you said about, like, the moralizing about the buddy fights, like, I don't think that Eddie is, like, some horrible monster for his behavior here. I just think it's kind of annoying on the show's part that they're acting like he's totally in the right here and Buck totally needs to apologize.
Yeah, even Hen's sympathy, like, feels kind of, like, it doesn't even really feel like she's, like, you know, seeing Buck's perspective. It seems more like it's coming from a place of, like, well, you're my friend and you have no one in your corner right now, so I guess I'll, you know, extend my good grace to you and, you know, get you this cupcake.
But there was, like, that one episode where she was being the one to, like, defend him moping around after being told he couldn't come back to work, right?
Right, yeah, but that's the one moment of it. That's, like, the one moment we get, like...
Right, we could have done with more of that.
So, no, yeah, we've talked about it. I feel like we're just talking in circles about the lawsuit arc at this point, and it is over. Yeah. Basically, this is the last little thread of the lawsuit arc that gets wrapped up in this scene.
We don't have to worry. I think this is probably, like, the last frustrating thing about it actively, so that's okay. In happier news, I wrote in my notes, I'm sorry, it's just that the emotional intensity of this scene is something that Buck does not have with any other supposedly platonic character on the show. Because it's just kind of weird that you know, this one scene, like, that this entire thing in this episode of him and Eddie beefing, like, he's not going through that with any other character. You know, him and Bobby are kind of beefing, and it is not the same at all. He's like, talking to him, you know, heart on his sleeve, like, tearing up, begging for his forgiveness. It's just a totally different dynamic that feels really unique to his and Eddie's thing. And it's just like, you know, it makes you think.
This isn't Buck and Bobby. This isn't Buck and Maddie. This isn't Buck and who else did he fight with? Athena, right? This is Buck and Abby. Okay, this is Buck and Taylor. What's happening here? This is Buck and someone he wants to fuck, okay, who is breaking his heart all over the place. You know?
It just, like, feels very intense. In a way that typically in fiction is reserved for non-platonic situations.
Yeah.
And then on Eddie's part, too, I always laugh at how fast Eddie forgives him. Like, for all we just said about, like, him being kind of unreasonably mad, then as soon as Buck is like, what do I have to do to get you to forgive me? Eddie's just like, I forgive you. Like, just don't do it again.
No, it is actually kind of funny in retrospect, because it's like, he had already made up his mind that he was, like, gonna forgive Buck, and he still loved him and everything, but he was just gonna yank his chain a little bit longer and, like, keep him in the doghouse a little bit longer to teach him a lesson.
He was literally just, and I think this is something you see come up with Eddie from time to time, where he seems to struggle with just, like, expressing his emotions, like, making the first move in doing that. He kind of wants other people to prompt him to express his emotions, especially when it comes to Buck, and I think that's what's going on here, is he was like, I was gonna forgive you, but, like, I wanted you to give me the attention to, like, say what I wanted to say and, you know, tell me you're sorry or whatever.
And that's so real. Honestly, I can't it even be mad real. At that. Like, I can't
be mad at that either. Like, his reasoning was faulty, like, but I do get that.
Yeah. Emotionally, I actually really identify about that with Eddie. I'm not gonna lie.
He just wanted that sort of emotional validation, but it's too bad that he couldn't extend that to Buck, I guess, in the story. Yeah.
But they hug.
Buck does his little bashful, teary smile, which again does not feel platonic. They hug, and this is actually a detail I'm embarrassed to say I've never noticed. When they hug, Eddie seems like the hug, like, hurts him.
Yeah,
and then
it hurts.
Pulls
like
away,
he winces.
And Buck,
he notices,
right? And Buck looks confused, but then Eddie walks away. And I've, for some reason, I never noticed that. I always just thought Eddie was just doing. I thought that was just like a grunt he does when he hugs people super hard.
Cool. Okay, I guess we just don't really see Eddie hug anyone else that hard. That is true.
Interesting.
But But interesting, interesting. I love how perceptive Buck is, that he's the only one that's noticed that Eddie is right. in pain.
It's true. It's true. He's the only one who remarks on it in this episode.
Yeah. But Bobby comes over and mm-hmm. tells Buck, there's kind of a fake out moment where, like, you think, is Bobby going to say that, like, he's transferring Buck? Is Bobby going to say that, right. like, you know, something, something, et cetera. And he says to Buck, you know, go home. Go home.
Just get the fuck out of here.
You've earned the evening off. You've played your part. And
yeah, he tells him that he doesn't want to overtax him. But, you know, Buck's put out by that. He's like, come on, like, put me in, coach. I'm still good to go. But yeah. Bobby insists. So we
and
see
thank
Buck
God
on
he
his
does.
Drive home.
Thank yeah. God he does.
Yes. Because... it turns out to be very fortuitous, because we mm-hmm. see him on his drive home stopping at a gas station. And who should pull up but the woman with the guy in her windshield. Ugh, don't you just love when storylines converge? Very Love Actually. Very Buck Actually.
Yeah, very Avengers, if you will. Buck,
but
he sees...
Buck, at first...
he laughs it off. It's so
Yeah, he
funny.
Thinks that this is all a Halloween decoration.
Yeah.
But then, just like the people before, he sees the guy move. So mm-hmm. he hops in the Jeep to pursue her. He calls 911 about it. He does the thing mm-hmm. where he's like, this is firefighter Evan Buckley, and I'm following a whatever gold sedan, and this is happening. He tries to, like, pull up alongside the car to tell the woman to pull over, but she doesn't. So he, like, pulls in front of her to kind of force her to stop. He gets out. The woman is being so funny. She's like, you're a terrible driver.
Yeah. No, it's so funny.
He says, ma'am, I'm a firefighter. And she says, well, your costume sucks. Because Buck is now in his street clothes.
I am obsessed with this woman.
I know.
Like,
she's
I
so funny.
I love her so much. But he goes to check her pupils and, like, their diet.
She has,
like,
one blown pupil. Yeah.
She has one blown pupil. They're fucked up. And instantly he just rushes in to help save the guy. The guy's mm-hmm. alive. And Buck, he goes to... you know, help the guy out, get him out of the car, and he ends up cutting himself. Uh-oh.
Yeah, on the windshield glass.
Yeah.
So when the paramedics show up, they, like, ask him if he's okay. He's like, oh, no, it's not my blood, but he looks down, and he's so sort of horrified, realizes that he is, in fact, bleeding, because he has minor cuts on his arm, but as he mentions, he's on blood thinners. They're kind of bleeding more profusely than usual.
He's basically like a late onset hemophiliac at this point. Like, you know, he gets cut and he doesn't stop.
You can see from his reaction that maybe he's worrying that, like, oh no, like another medical thing.
Yeah.
Like, will I be able to work again or whatever? But we cut away for now to Maddie coming to see Chimney at the fire station. Mm-hmm. He starts to apologize because he knows he was harsh the other night, but Maddie actually says he was right. Which, you know, again, he wasn't really right about the Doug thing. But...
yeah, and she specifically says, like, you know, I was kind of acting like Duck. And I'm like, Maddie, no, don't buy into the propaganda. No, don't
it's
do it.
It's not quite the same thing.
Yeah.
But Chimney, like, affirms her. He's like, you're not crazy. You are just still healing. You know, mm-hmm. obviously this is still going. And she says, and I liked this because he kind of helps refute this whole Doug thing here. Mm-hmm. Maddie says something like, he was a monster. Remember, the title of this episode is Monsters.
Drink.
He was a monster. And she's like, if he was a monster and I did all this stuff, then what does that make me? And Chimney says, what does he say?
I don't remember. Oh, you know what? Well, first of all, I just have to give a brief aside because I just love the idea of, you know, the new Ryan Murphy miniseries Monster, the Maddie Buckley story.
But yeah, Chimney says, like, no, you're not a monster. You're just, I forget exactly what he says, but he says something affirming.
Okay. So she's talking about how, like, she, you know, she feels like she's, like, sort of, like, losing her mind a little bit. He's like, you know, I feel like I'm going crazy. Like, we're crazy for crazy.
Right.
Because, like, I have seen this fucking spooky crow that's been haunting me this whole episode, and I don't know what to do about it. No one will believe me. I'm losing my mind over here about this goddamn crow. And she goes, that crow? And he's like, yeah, that crow. She's like, no, that crow on the ambulance? Oh, she's the first one who sees the crow.
They're so perfect for each other. Mm-hmm. So he's like, finally, like, you can see it too. And then the crow drops Chimney's name tag It turns out this crow is officially uncanceled because it turns out this crow was only following him to return his lost property. What a mensch of a crow.
A mensch of a crow, an ally, and just an all-around G, this crow is. We love this guy, and we would like to invite him back for more episodes as Chimney's sidekick, although we know that he does have scheduling conflicts. Because he's very in demand.
And if the crow would ever like to come on the podcast, he's welcome to reach out to us. If he, if I could just get his agent's name, I would send an email.
I took crow as an elective in high school, so I think we'll be, you know, able to communicate.
You can talk to him.
It'll be great.
Well, Chimney is like, wow, he was just trying to return my thing, except now he knows my name, and you get like one last moment of Chimney paranoia. It's pretty good.
Right. It's good. But then we get a very fanfic trope moment where where Bobby goes to the hospital and he goes, hi, I'm looking for a patient named Evan Buckley.
He's like rushing to the hospital. He's very worried about Buck because he heard Buck was in the hospital. Yeah. But Buck walks out and he's like totally fine. He's like, oh yeah, no, I just had like some cuts on my arm, but you know, they patched me up. And he explains what happened. He's, you know, this whole situation with the guy in the windshield. Turns out the woman had a brain bleed, which is why she was not at 100%. And the guy from the windshield is in surgery, and it looks like he has a pretty good shot. So Bobby says to Buck, he's like, it probably didn't even occur to you to worry about yourself while you were saving these people. And Buck kind of takes this as like an insult. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, I just jumped in like I always do. And I guess it's the uniform. It's like the uniform is my costume. Right. Very child thing of Buck to say.
This episode should have been called Costumes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're all wearing costumes.
Should have been called Masks.
Oh, my God. Masks.
They're all wearing costumes.
Yes.
But Buck is like, I guess the uniform is like my costume. It feels like without it, I'm not much of anything. But Bobby says, you save two lives without the uniform. It's not a costume. It's who you are. So I guess this was enough to tell Bobby that Buck is finally ready to be back on duty. Yeah. It only took like two episodes for this whole thing to be started and ended.
It's reminding me so much of this thing RuPaul always talks about in interviews where she was in like a meeting with her therapist, and her therapist said to her, that this is life-changing to her. Her therapist said to her, Ru, what you need to understand is that the power that is available to you when you're in drag is also available to you when you're out of drag.
Ooh.
What?
That is mind-blowing. And that is so applicable to this scene. The firefighter uniform is basically Buck's drag.
It is. He's in real adult person drag, and he's using that to save
like
real adult lives. He feels like a big, strong, strapping man, you know, when he puts that on.
Yeah, it makes him feel like so powerful and like in present in his body and stuff. And when he's out of it, he just feels like some guy. But Bobby's here to tell him that power you have in your firefighter uniform, you still have that when you're in your overly tight skinny jeans and overly tight long sleeve shirts and you know, button ups and whatnot. So Bobby is finally ready to let Buck back for real. You know, he says, it's time for me to get out of your way. And Buck even offers to buy him breakfast, and they walk off into the sunset together. Not a very Halloween-y ending, I must say. Like, it ends on a bit of a schmaltzy note.
Yeah.
They should have, like, walked out of the hospital, and then, like, a big spooky ghost jumps out.
Yeah.
And murders both of them.
How fun. They walk out, and they just see a witch fly by on her broom, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa.
The witch is like, oh.
Wow. I guess the I can't tie it into the episode title. I can't think of anything. I'm sorry. Oh, you know what? Zombies are attacking LA. Zombies are everywhere, right? And so they're like,
and they're playing
wow.
the music from Disney's Zombies.
I was thinking, what if like instead they just do something like really like sort of like kind of tone deaf, like they do like the Cranberries Zombie, like
right,
a song
right.
that's not all at all about the undead, and they're just like, whoa, most insane needle drop.
I mean, that would be in character for 911, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, none of that actually happens, and instead, you know, we just end on this touching father-son kind of scene. But ultimately, I'd say it was a pretty good Halloween episode.
Yeah, we got some spookiness in there. We got some psychological elements in there. We got a bevy of Hitchcock references in there. It was a very cerebral right. take on the Halloween Network TV episode, which I enjoyed.
Yes, very.
Good character drama.
We got a good dose of a lot of characters' drama. Of course, we could have used a little more from Hen, but many such cases, am I right?
Hey, women, you know?
You know, it's fine. It's fine. Women, it's fine. You can only have so many women having drama in one episode.
Right? Because that's all they do. That's all they just all have drama.
Exactly. I've had enough women drama for a lifetime. Am I right, boys?
Pass me another brewski, bro.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, on that note, it's been a fun episode.
It has.
And thanks for tuning in to another holiday seasonal installment of the First Risk Podcast. You can check us out on all our social medias, spelled how it sounds, and you can even subscribe to our Patreon now, where mm-hmm. we have our Patreon bonus episode about Ryan Guzman's The Boy Next Door already posted, and then very soon we will be recording our bonus episode that looks like it's going to be about the case for and against gay Eddie. One of us is going to have to play straight Eddie's advocate, which will be funny.
That will be very funny. And the role of a lifetime, it needs to be said. In the meantime, right. Look forward
You're gonna
to...
You're going to win your Tony for that.
Thank you. I've been waiting for this day. At least a drama desk. If I at least get like a drama desk and like a nomination, then I'll be happy.
Right. Maybe an Obie.
Right. Right. Well, I feel like that would disqualify me from the Tonys, wouldn't it, if I won an Obie for it?
Listen, I don't know as much about this as you do.
Okay, well, listen, we'll say it's a film performance, and I'll say I will be happy with just the Golden Globe and to share the stage with my fellow nominees at the Academies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, you can look forward to hearing us back on your headphones next week when we cover Athena Begins.
Ooh, interesting.
Interesting.
We'll see how
episode.
That works out. Oh, and... Right. And by the time we post this episode, I think my video about the Step Up movies
Ooh,
will be live. So yes. Head to the Jane Mulcahy channel if you want to see a really rather dry and scholarly discussion of most of all of the Step Up movies. I mean, you know, keep watching because the first couple of reviews are kind of more like dry and scholarly, and then I get more funny as the video goes on, which is unfortunate because normally you kind of want to put the funny stuff at the beginning of the video so people will not click away, but we'll see how it works out.
Okay, well, in the interest of not disclaiming anything and just getting people hyped up and jazzed about the video, we'll just say, you know, Jane is a consummate professional. She always brings a sense of nuance and research to her projects, and you can look forward to a in-depth analysis of the Step Up franchise and its influences on her channel. So go check that out.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you are
I will
say, interested.
I think I was a little too hard on Step Up Revolution. So if you hear me saying some mean things about it in the video, no, that I have come around on it a little bit more. It's kind of like my Eddie section in my 911 video.
All of our Step Up Revolution shooters listening will be very incensed by this.
I never know going into a video drop like what parts will be controversial. I usually anticipate certain parts being controversial, and then those ones are fine, and then it turns out random parts of the video that I had no idea would be controversial prove to be controversial. So it's always a gamble. We'll see.
We will see indeed. Well, listen, guys, if we can leave you with one last little piece of advice, don't fucking throw rocks at crows. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Leave crows alone.
Don't do it. Okay? They're nice. They're friends.
Crows are not for eating. They're not for hitting. They are for loving and respecting and being homies with.
You wouldn't throw a rock at your homie, would you?
And you wouldn't download a car.
You wouldn't.
And you wouldn't drive your car into a guy who goes through your windshield.